Thanks for tuning in to today's very special episode of the Comedy at the Carlson Cast. It is brought to you by our friends at Sport Cafe and Catering, Rochester's favorite spot for lunch and all of your catering needs. Find them on Facebook and Instagram at Sapori Rochester. Also, Three Heads Brewing, the makers of Rochester's favorite beer. Remember, do good things and always be kind. And let's start up a show. Well, everyone, I hope you had an amazing Thanksgiving, and we are glad to be doing this special best of episode of the Comedy of the Carlson Cast for you. 2019 has been great so far. We've had the opportunity to talk to some amazing performers. Today's show is a compilation of some of the most interesting and funny things that we think have happened on the show. We hope you agree. We had to take, you know, little clips about lots of different topics, but one of the things we always like to talk about performers about are how they got into comedy, where they started. And this story is particularly interesting. We're going to start off with our friend Felipe Esparza, who you may know battled a serious drug addiction. And he was pretty open about visiting rehab and getting started on the path to comedy. We'll let him tell you the story. Here's Felipe.
So can I backtrack for a second here? I'm really fascinated by your story. So you were sober for 10 years. At what point did you decide to step on a stand-up stage?
As soon as I came out of rehab, I went to do stand-up.
Really?
When I was like selling drugs, I told this guy, he was the first guy I ever told, and I had to buy drugs off him to sell. Mm-hmm. And I told him, you know, he just looked at me, man. He goes, "You're funny." He goes, "You know, it's funny you say that. I always wanted to be a comedian, like I said, I was a little kid." He goes, "Fuck it, homie. You should just do it, homie. Fuck all this. You gotta be out here fucking around. If you wanna do it, just do it." So I said, "You're right." So it took me like a year later. I came out of rehab. When I was in rehab, we had a guy, this Catholic brother. Mm-hmm. He came down and he goes, he was talking to us. He goes, "I want you guys to write down your five dreams, your goals." But we heard dreams first. So me and a bunch of old heroin addicts were writing down, I have this dream where I wake up with money and it's gone. I have a dream where I'm naked in class. Then the guy took he ripped the paper. He goes, no, not describe what you dream about. What are your goals in life? So it's sad, you know, because there were a lot of guys there who were 60 years old. They spent half of their life in prison, and they were actually writing down stuff they wanted to be, like fireman, teacher. Here's a guy that done half of his life. He wanted to be a teacher. But I wrote down I wanted to be a comedian.
Was his name Todd?
Nah, his name was Killer.
Okay. I'm just wondering, because I know a guy who was in rehab who became a teacher.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering. Just kidding.
Mr. Teetsort.
Sorry, Gerslin.
So this guy, I wrote down I wouldn't be a comedian. And he goes, number two, I like Olive Garden, so I want to go to Italy. I want to do the real tour of Italy,
not
just
the
plate.
It's not exactly the same.
Try ordering carbonara over there. See how it goes for
you. And always, like the Godfather, you know, my favorite scene is when they get married and that band is playing in front of them. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, and they're walking through the
best
town.
Best scene ever.
Yeah.
And so I wrote down that. Third, I want to just be happy. Four and five, I didn't write shit down. I forgot. So when I come out of rehab, I have a goal. I have a plan now. I never had a plan in my life. So I go straight to the library because that's the only thing I knew. Public library, Los Angeles County Library. It's like five stories. It's huge. And I walked up to the librarian and I said, I walked up to her like she was a career guidance, like a career guidance counselor.
Sure.
Miss Ruby, that's not her name, but I said, I want to be a comedian. And she looked at me with her glasses and her chain. She goes, all right. But I don't know how to write jokes. She goes, I need structure. I want to know how to write. So she took me to this long section of the library. And there was a bunch of comedy writing books. And she got one called Comedy Writing Step by Step by Gene Perrette.
It's one of my favorite books ever.
Yeah. And I checked it out, and I never brought it back. And that was my book. That was my Bible for a long time.
Yeah,
I just read that book, and then I read another book that was even better than that one. It was called How to Write Funny, Be Funny, Perform Funny, and Make Money Out of Being Funny. So that joke, that book, it like broke down styles. I didn't know styles. I know like deadpan and then like all these type of comedians. Sure. So I gravitated to the deadpans because I was very shy.
Yeah.
So my favorite comedian were immediately was Stephen Wright.
No, Stephen Wright's the freaking
Yeah, man. So I said, damn. So one night, I'm working at Dodger Stadium, and the Dodgers are playing the New York Mets. And who comes in to buy a hot dog? Stephen Wright.
You're kidding.
He comes in with a real shitty-ass hair and skinny heroin body.
I'm not going to throw stones, Felipe, but I don't think you should be calling anybody shitty ass hair.
Okay, because well,
how are you going to be like that to our guest?
What is Stephen Wright going to do to me? You're going to walk up to me and fucking beat his ass. You know, I'm not afraid of his ass. Fuck him. You know?
And he's like 70.
Who cares, eh? Hey, who cares? If you're, it doesn't matter what age you are. If you step up to a man and talk shit, get ready to get knocked out. You know what I mean? Just don't walk up to people, you know? Uh-huh. But anyways, I see Stephen Wright. Nobody recognizes him. I'm like starstruck.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, I'm telling all my friends. You know who that is? The fucking legend.
I'd be frozen in
He's
my
a
shoes.
Fucking Oscar winner, bro. A comedian. He was best jokes ever. You know, Rodney Dangerfield presents.
And he walks up and says, yeah, I have a hot dog.
Yeah. And I walked. I ran out of the kitchen, greasy as hell, and I shook my hand out. You're Stephen Wright. You're the greatest comedian ever. You're a legend. And then he put his hand inside his hoodie. Cause he's like a germaphobe, I didn't know, and he shook my hand with his
sleeve,
the sleeve,
close enough,
and he goes, "Hey, nice to meet you too," and I walked away and I said, "Hell yeah,
that's cool,
that's awesome."
And I didn't even care that he shook his hand with his palm with his hoodie, cause I was greasy, I was dirty, bro.
Sure,
and I've been in that situation now. If somebody walk up to me like that, I don't even take my hand out, fist bump, buddy.
Yeah.
So I met him. He gave me some pretty nice advice. He was very good. And then I met another comedian from the Comedy Store that she was involved in that comedy strike, Elaine Boozler.
Oh, yeah.
So she was very nice to me.
Wow.
She just told me, you just got to write every day.
So, okay. I want to compliment you. I love that you just went and tried to actually learn about comedy. So many people forget that step. To actually look at comedy as an art, and
I know, man. They look at somebody who's already made it, like Tosh.0 or
and try to copy
like Louis C.K. or David Tell. Oh, that's how you do it. I just talk like him.
Nah, man.
It takes years. You think it took Louis C.K. overnight to get like that? Hell no.
I love Felipe. I hope he comes back. True story. Pulling down the curtain for you. I legitimately thought he was going to punch Brian in the face for making that comment about his hair. Now. Our next clip is from a megastar, Marlon Wayans. He came in and did us the pleasure of sitting on our couch and talking to us, and we had an interesting conversation about how he deals with people who are not very nice on social media. I would say not well, and I would advise you not to troll Marlon Wayans.
See, we're suffocated by social media. We're influenced by the media. People, and this is why comedians do stand-up comedy, because people don't give a fuck. People ain't as tight-wound as you would think. People don't get up and walk out of my show. Oh, I can't believe you're talking. No. People want to hear those dark thoughts. People want to hear you say funny things about taboo subjects because people want to laugh. It's the social media, and this is what's crazy. And I can't believe that people can't see it. It's not even all of social media. It's these fucking trolls that aren't real people that are literally sent by other countries, other governments, other nations, trying to influence our thoughts and our behavior. And they're fucking winning. We're killing our First Amendment. We're killing it. We are killing it.
Now because of Facebook.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because of Instagram. Because of Facebook. Because of Twitter. You know, Twitter gets on my nerves. I just mute people all day long. It's like people tell me, you could tell them throwing their ideas out there to try and, you know, get you all riled up so that the media picks up on this. And now they blast it out to the people and then they're programming the people what the fuck they're supposed to think. When in reality is we live in America and it's okay to disagree and it's okay to have a difference of opinion. Sorry.
Yeah.
I have to say, you brought up the social media stuff. I was really disappointed in the country a little bit. I was disappointed in a lot of people with the situation you went through last summer.
When what happened last summer? What did I do?
Well, when you wished your daughter a happy Pride Month.
Oh.
And people jumped down your throat for it.
No, but that's once again. That's like, they can, you can. I've been groomed for that shit. I want that. So if I put something out there about my daughter, you're fucking with the wrong dad.
Right.
You want to be trolled? Fuck with me. I will troll you. One Christmas, I posted a picture of my daughter. It was the night before Christmas. Posted a picture of us. It was Christmas time. It was me and my daughter. And someone said something about my daughter. And I missed Christmas. Like, literally, because all I did all night long, I blacked out. I got on my face, my social media, and I took pictures of him, and I started posting pictures of him. I trolled this motherfucker. I trolled and bullied this motherfucker all damn day. My daughter woke up. She said, "Dad, are you still doing that?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "But it's Christmas." I said, "Yeah. Give me about 3 more hours, send it, and then we'll open the fucking gifts." And I went in. I'm the wrong dad. And when you talk about, like, and it's like, I tell her, it's like, you know, when she got trolled for her being gay, it's like, I want to leave those comments up there. Because people are like, why don't you take them down? No, I want people to see ignorance. Because people are
and
start attacking
and their
ignorance.
Names right next to it.
Yeah. And you know what I say? In 20 years, I'm going to remember that fucking guy. And I forget, it's like Chez135. And in 20 years, when my daughter's, she'll be 39, I'm going to have my daughter fuck his daughter.
All right. Revenge is
playing the long game.
What if he doesn't have a daughter?
Long game.
What if he doesn't have a daughter?
Then I gotta get my son to Pride Month.
Either way, this guy's kid's getting fucked.
His kids are getting fucked. That's all I'm saying.
So I hate to do this to you because we don't like to do this type of show, but ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the studio, Chaz1135.
Come on in, Chaz.
But here's the thing, right? I look at my life as a comedian. I go, I'm so grateful because I could take any situation that's absolutely the craziest situation. I could always find a smile. And I want that for every human being. Like, the people out there committing suicides and things like that, like, those thoughts don't hit my mind because before I get to feeling that sorry for myself, I go, what's funny about this shit? What's funny about the worst thing in my life? And then I smile, and I feel good. And I feel like, all right, well, that happened. I've smiled at that. Now let me go fuck up again so I can smile some more.
You know what? I feel like I owe you a $50 copay for that advice. That's pretty good stuff.
Well, and you're right, though. And going back to what you were saying about social media, everything's designed to make you feel worse. You know,
when did depression really start hitting people? At its highest right now. The social media has... Look at the suicide rates. Look at how depressed teenagers are because everybody's on their fucking phone and they're not living life. Everybody's being bullied by millions of people instead of like the 3 that's at your school that all you gotta do is take a karate class and in 5 months you're gonna kick him in his fucking throat and everybody's gonna be like, yeah, you did it. And then he becomes your best friend. But nowadays everybody's hiding behind these stupid little profile pics and, you know, whatever, and they say all these mean things, but they're not even real people. Like, yeah. and these kids.
The sad thing is, though, they are real people. That's what's so messed up about it.
The real people aren't real people, man. Those are people with some kind of fucking agenda or some, those are pussies. Those aren't real people. Real people say it to your face. If you have an opinion about me, if you have the balls to say it to my face, I'm gonna fuck with you. I'm like, I'll fuck with that guy. But if you don't talk to me and you don't even have the balls to put your real picture of you up, you got a picture of a sock puppet. Shut the fuck up. I don't care what you gotta say. Then if you say something real, say it to my face. I'm a New Yorker. Most of my best friends, you know when I made my best friends? I punched them in the face. We had a fight and they became, or we got in a headlock, or we almost fought. But that was us agreeing to disagree and then going, but I like that you stood up for yourself.
That's it. There's
and
a respect.
And we became best friends.
There's a respect there.
Vinny punches me all the time.
Yeah, sometimes you got to punch somebody in their face and go, here's the line that I draw. You can say, you can talk about my mom, my fucking grandma. She's sick right now. Not this week. Next week, when, like, next week when she's better, you can talk about it again. Yeah. Not this week. You know, you just got to learn the lines between people, and that comes from hanging out with people. I watch my kids on there, they hang out with their friends. You know what they fucking do?
Stare at their phones while they're sitting there hanging out.
What about talking to each other? What are you looking at? Like, fuck this. Put it down and just talk to each other. Go watch a fucking movie.
Starting out in stand-up comedy is really, really difficult. And everybody approaches it from a different direction. Our next clip is from the great Harlan Williams. You may know him from There's Something About Mary and the creator of Paw Patrol on Disney. He is doing quite well for himself with that. But when he started doing stand-up comedy, he tends to be a bit of a silly heart, and he definitely took that approach. Give it a listen.
You go to an open mic, you hit it up. Yeah. How did you prepare? Like, I mean, you want to keep this silly edge,
yeah,
but you also want to do stand-up. And stand-up is silly, but traditionally most stand-up isn't really that silly. It's more, you know, yeah, talking. How did you reconcile those in your own head starting
out? Well, I wore long johns my first night, full body long johns with the flap okay. in the back.
That's a hell of an icebreaker.
Right? A pair of checkered shorts that I drew. I had white shorts, but I drew checkers on them with a Sharpie. And a friend of mine had found a priest's, like a Pope-like robe, poncho, at a thrift shop, at a Salvation Army shop. So I went out, long johns, Kodiak work boots, checkered shorts, with a priest's like thing with the colored, you know, right, cross down the middle.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And underneath it, I had a plastic toy rifle. And I walked out on stage, and my opening line was, "Sure, I wanted to be Pope, just like every other kid on my street." And then I did the whistle from The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, and I threw the poncho over my shoulder and pulled out the rifle and it just went from there.
Wow.
Ridiculous, yeah.
What year was this?
This was like 82 or 83.
Wow.
So it just started off.
Yeah, that
silly.
Might not go as well today.
Yeah, I was going to say, 2019, that is not going over.
You never know.
The second you pull a gun out in 2019,
yeah,
you immediately
hit
this
back. Interesting. Yeah.
That's a hell of a way to start,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to start and make a difference, you know, because comedy's visual and comedy should be original and comedy should be irreverent and make you think and challenge you. And so I just tried to provide a verbal and visual smorgasbord to offset people and their senses, you know, and it worked. It got people reacted to it. They really laughed.
I really appreciate how you broke it down at that point in your career to strategy.
Yeah.
You're like, I got to get over and I got to find a way to make this work.
Yeah.
It's my first time, so I'm really going to pull out all the stops and try to come up with something.
Well, I went on stage thinking, I don't want to be a guy that people just don't remember. I don't want to be a guy that just stands up there and talks. I want to be the guy that stands out, that when people leave, they go, oh, that guy.
Remember the guy who brandished the gun?
Yeah.
Even I'd remember that, and I don't remember anything.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Yeah. So I think that's what I try to do effectively in everything I do, in my movies, in my whatever I do that's creative. I try to do something that can leave an impression, you know?
I'm not going to lie to you. If someone walked in the new comic night dressed like that, I don't know what I would think. I'd probably be a little creeped out. Now, our next clip, we are talking to the great Mr. Mark Normand. And Mark talked a little bit about one of the hardest things to do in stand-up comedy, and that's find your own voice, learning how to be you and authentic to you on stage. And he told it in a great way. So here it is, Mark Normand on Finding Your Voice.
How far along were you when you started really getting laughs? When you really started realizing you were getting stuff together?
It took years.
Yeah.
Year. I mean, I bombed forever. I was a punchline. No, you know, no pun intended. But I probably bombed in New York for like 3 years straight. I'd get a titter here and there, but I was so stand-up-y. Like, I was so Seinfeld-y and what's the deal with? Because that's all I knew. I had horrible jokes. One of my jokes was like, why do we say when something's easy, we go, or when something's hard, we go, it's no picnic. No picnic. Picnics are tough. You got to go out there in the sun and get a blanket. The ants show up. No picnic. More like a picnic. And people would be like, ugh. You know, I'm in New York at like the height of like alt comedy. You know, it's like shit like that. So I'm that guy. I remember one time I walked on stage at an open mic and another comic went, and it crushed me. I got a big laugh, and I remember I was like, ruined.
Right in the dick.
Comedy was way harsher when I started. Like now, I mean, I hate to sound like old man Norman, but like now it's like very huggy feely and progressive, and you're great, and everyone's great, and we're all equal. And when I started, it was vicious. Yeah. It was really mean, and no one would laugh at you. And all the other comics, we all kind of competed, and it made you a better comic, but it was pretty gruesome.
Yeah.
But I remember I was bombing forever. I got just used to bombing. Like, I'm just going to go on and bomb. It was just a normal thing. Like, if I got a laugh, that was weird. That's where I was at.
It surprised you.
Yeah. And I remember I was on stage, and this guy kept heckling
Excuse me, I'm trying to finish. Stop.
I remember I went on stage at a place called Mo Pitkins. It's no longer there, but it was like a big, hot show, and you had to put your name in a bucket. And if you got on, it was like a big deal. It was an open mic. And I got on, and I was bombing as usual. This is probably 2.5 years into living in New York. Mm-hmm. No money, no nothing, no future. And I'm just miserable, bombing. And this guy keeps heckling me, and I just fucking lose it on him. I go, you fucking piece of shit. And it was killing. For the first time, I'm killing. And this guy heckling me, I can't remember what I said to him, but I was like, just every day job and the fucking trains and living in Brooklyn and being broke, it all just kind of poured out of me. And that's when I was like, oh, it cracked me of learning how to be myself.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Because I just shed that whole, like, what's the deal with? And I just became myself shitting on this guy. And it was like a epiphany moment. Like, holy shit, this is me. Why was I pretending to be this kind of stand-up-y thing?
Why do you think you were pretending to be such?
I just thought that's how you did it. I was just so dumb. I was just so green. I just thought, like, oh, we're comics. This is how it works. Seinfeld's famous. I'll just do what he did, you know?
Wow.
And that getting heckled, I was so mad at the guy, but it, like, it opened me up to being myself, and that changed everything.
Yeah. They say, you know, finding your voice, but I've always worded it like it's realizing what your own voice sounds like.
Right.
You know, realizing, like, oh, I can't pull off that stuff. I need to do something else.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, totally. And also the low self-esteem, so I go, I don't want to sound anything like me. I suck.
Yeah.
But you should be doing you. Even if you do suck, just go with that.
Yeah.
It's better to just be you, you know? Because how long, even if you're faking it, how long can you do that?
Yeah.
Like, let's say that catches on. Like, that's why you're like a Larry the Cable Guy or a Dice or basically any character. I would hate to be, I mean, sure, it's a hit, but do you really want to live like that?
Yeah.
You know, you want to be stuck in that? The whole beauty of comedy is the honesty, and you can tell the truth. And, like, what gets a bigger laugh than a joke bombing? Go, well, that joke bombed. That gets a big laugh. Mm-hmm. Because you're just going, oh, yeah, this just happened. This is a real moment. We all felt it.
I feel like one of the biggest lessons that I've ever learned is kind of what you're talking about, is how learning just to be in the moment and acknowledging what's actually happening and not keeping yourself stuck in material.
Totally.
I feel like that's a really interesting way that you kind of came about it.
Yeah.
Of you just shed it. I'm out of it. I'm me. Let's go.
Yeah.
And that was it.
That was it.
And no looking back.
Obviously, material is important. You know, you want to record an album or do TV, you have to have your jokes. But, like, it's got to be on some level, it's got to be in the moment. It's got to be realistic and natural.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that had to change the way you approach joke writing.
Completely. Completely.
Interesting. Yeah.
Louis once saw me, this is again years ago before.
Anderson?
No, I'm just kidding. Cats. he's another Louis. No one will get that except comics. But he saw me and he goes, hey, that's a funny joke, but who cares? And I was like, well, what do you mean? He's like, it's a good premise, but who gives a shit? He's like, you should just make it about you somehow. And I was like, ah. He's like, just make it about you and the audience won't be confused. Because they're sitting there going, I get what he's saying, but why is he saying it? And that will take away from the funny.
Oh, wow,
so he just said, make every joke about you somehow. Even if it has nothing to do with it, even if it's about Pluto, somehow spin it back into your whatever. And that changed. That was a big joke writing tool.
That's a really interesting thought.
Yeah, I have a joke, an old joke in my first album about gay guys must be, or Jews must be jealous of gays because Jews are always like, we got to live on, we got to stick with each other and reproduce and make more Jews. And gays are like, we can't even reproduce and we keep popping up. Blah, right. blah, blah. That was the whole premise. And everybody was like, you're not gay or Jewish. What are you talking about? So I made up this whole thing about how I dated a Jewish girl and we were about to get married and her parents wouldn't let me and all that. And then the joke started working.
Wow.
So that's an example of just making it about you somehow.
There's some kind of joke in there about Louis making things about himself.
For those of you watching at home.
Yeah.
For those of you watching at home, comedy is filled with lies. Just so you all know.
Completely.
Just
completely.
Filled what? With lies.
Not yeah. me. Not me.
Just a way to get
as
into
honest
it.
As we all are. We're all yeah. a bunch
yeah.
of liars.
Yeah. It's well, pretty... it's, you still have to construct a joke.
Sure.
We have a simple rule of comedy at the Carlson. Book the funniest performers that we possibly can, male or female. Unfortunately, not all clubs are like that. There is a struggle for female performers that is very much real, and it's not always recognized. And our next couple blocks, we talk to some very funny female performers about this very topic. We hope that you find it entertaining and enlightening. Our first clip is with our pal, and she'll be back here this December, Miss April Macy.
It's tough
life.
Being a woman in comedy.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. horrifying.
Horrifying.
Well, I think, you know, I've taken screenshots. My favorite thing to do is to take screenshots of, like, comedy club calendars
uh-huh.
where it'll be, like, the upcoming month. And then I just, it's 70, I took one. It was like, I just go through across the country. So you can go across the country. It was 72 weeks. Two were women out of 72, and one was a medium. You're like, why do you have to speak to the dead as a woman to get on stage? You can't even speak to the living. Only one's allowed to speak to the living. You're like, they're half your
gimmick.
Audience.
Yeah.
And women typically are the social planners. Like women, you know, men just kind of put on their pants and go where they're told. It's not like men are just out there making plans all day.
Yeah. Accurate.
Yeah.
Accurate.
So to me, it's like to not cater to half your audience, especially when women come out in lady packs. Some clubs are, like, better with women than other clubs. Like, I think
Random
this one's,
packs of ladies.
This one's good. Random packs of ladies. Dudes don't come out in dude packs unless they're out to rape ladies.
That's a solo activity, I think, really.
Yeah, well, most of those guys.
I don't know how it works. I don't know how it works. I felt like they just get their rape gear on and roll out.
Get in the van, boys.
Everybody, it's raping night. It's raping night.
Oh, God, like, it's so weird to me, because now I'm just sitting here thinking from my own experience. You know, I work a lot, and you're not wrong. You're
no,
not
I mean,
wrong at all.
My daughter's 16, and yeah. she, like, wants to start stand-up, and I'm like, I don't
well,
know.
It's just, like, there's nothing I can do about it. You just, it is what it is, so I think you just have to work through it. But sometimes yeah. when I see men that work that I know are just wild
just
pieces
suck.
Of shit. Like, yeah. as a woman, if I behaved the way some of these dudes behave, like, I heard one story in Chicago where they, you know, you get ground transportation, they mm-hmm. pick you up from the airport, mm-hmm. and the guy threw up in the guy's, like, SUV, and the vomit went down the window, so he had to go and take the door apart, because it was Chicago in the summertime. And so it started to cook and, like, smell.
And that Chicago's a humid city.
I would never work again in Chicago. That would be it. Like, I'd be banned from Chicago.
You'd
but
be
as
called
that,
the puke.
Yeah, puke lady. Ah, oh, can you believe that woman was here? What? Yeah.
April Macy, did she throw up all over your car?
It would be from town to town. But this dude now in his contract just has no ground transportation. You're like, wait, he gets to come back. He just doesn't get picked up at the airport. You're like, that would never be the case as a woman.
That's really, you know, again, there probably is a double standard, you know.
Yeah.
In the comedy world, you know, it does seem to be very, very much a guy's club. I could see it.
And you're like, oh, can ladies be funny? And they're like, even, but though when you hear it from women, to me that's the most heartbreaking after a show is like a woman will be like, well, when I knew it was a lady comic, I was like, I don't think I want to go. And you're like, you're a woman, you horrible twat. You horrible, horrible twat.
Is there a double standard? I don't have all the answers, but I do know that there are a lot of strong opinions out there. Our next clip about the very same topic is with our friend and Syracuse, New York's own, Miss Jessie Mae Peluso.
Let's start with a slightly loaded question, and this is going to be kind of an intense one, but I'm curious because I listened back to our old interview, and there was something I wanted to ask you. I looked back at my notes, and we never got to it.
Sure. But
second interview, I feel like maybe we could talk a little more seriously about
some stuff. That's
really
presumptuous of you.
Very much so. I'm pretty bad like that.
I'm scared for this question.
No, it's not a bad question. I'm just really curious. You know, you've been, was this your 16th year doing comedy, roughly?
Going into 15th or 16th. I'd have to check my comedy books. Okay. Around there.
Well over a decade.
Yeah.
How do you feel the climate has changed towards female performers since when you started and where we are now? And do you feel, you know, like it has changed in a lot of ways?
Yeah, I mean, change is inevitable. It's a part of every process. I don't view it as a handicap. I don't view it as an advantage. I've never really considered being a female comedian, just a comic. I think the people who make it the worst sometimes are the women.
Okay.
I feel like, you know, they victimize themselves, some of them.
Okay.
And use it to get ahead, use that victimization to get ahead instead of overcoming it and figuring out how to manipulate it into humor. They use it and manipulate it into a crutch.
Okay. Very
And then there's the other side of it where there are women who are, you know, utilizing what's been going on in our industry. There's been a lot of, you know, as a female, yeah, I've had dudes who've been super inappropriate with me, who've said sexual things and who have been, you know, demeaning and all of that. And there are women who are bringing that to light, which is necessary.
Right.
Because that shit's got to change.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and it will. But it's this weird dichotomy between the women who are using it to evolve the situation in a positive way. And there are women who are keeping it in this like purgatory and not evolving. You know, they don't evolve themselves because they don't want to do the work they have to do in order to get over whatever issue they have. So they use it as this sort of crutch. Does that make sense?
It does. I'm just going to ask you a couple like follow-up questions because that was really fascinating, and I really love having this conversation.
Are we supposed to keep this funny?
No, we can talk about... Listen, we talk about whatever's going on, and we'll get funny. We'll make this funny at some point. We'll try really hard.
Did I get too deep? I'm just trying to break it down because it's an interesting situation, especially being a woman.
I think you're 100% right, too.
You know, I can remember a specific...
But as a dude, I can't say that.
Yeah, well, it's just different experiences, you know? I remember a specific situation where I was at the Improv, and I was with an agent. I won't say who, if it was my agent or not. It was just an agent.
Okay.
And a potential manager to rep me was there. And this guy and I just hit it off on a professional level with chemistry. You can have professional chemistry. We're just talking and riffing and you know, communicating. And the agent at the bar looked at us and was like, Jesus, you guys gonna fuck tonight? And like, even though we were in a bar setting, we're three professionals.
Yeah.
We were there for a purpose of talking about whether this gentleman could rep me or not.
And then all of a sudden it becomes very
weird. All of a sudden it becomes, you know, a sexual situation. So that's on the lower totem, the lower part of the totem as far as like experiences. But it's
still shitty,
right? Because you're not, the reverse isn't gonna happen.
Yeah,
the reverse just doesn't really happen as often as that. So there are some situations we need to get the fuck over and evolve.
Was there ever a time where you felt that you were passed over for anything because you were a woman, or a time that you felt like you were specifically, you know, marginalized because of the fact that you were female?
I think it does happen all the time in both aspects. Like, won't get the gig because you're female, or will get the gig because you're female. Both those, I don't think either of those things are good. I think...
You don't think they even each other out?
No, they don't, because it's like, even like comedian, I'm just a comic. Yeah. You dudes are just comics. I'm just a comic. Why do we have to add the female perspective or the female you know, wording to it?
I've always preferred just being called comic than comedian anyway, but that's a whole other, that's a whole other thing. That's like a soda pop argument.
Well, you know? It is.
I like comic too, because it makes me feel like I'm Spider-Man or something.
It makes me feel like, but when people are like comedian, I'm like, really? I'm just a comic, you know? The core should be funny. Is it funny? And are you coming from a real place? And are you a good person? The rest of the shit can fall to the wayside, I think.
Couldn't argue there. Couldn't argue there, because, you know, one of the things that we say a lot on this show is that, you know, there's lots of different types of comedy. As long as it's making people laugh and people are enjoying it.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
All day long.
My voice drives me nuts. I feel like my voice pierces.
You're in the wrong business, young lady. It's a break it
thing. Yeah. Well. Syracuse just came out. Absolutely. I look like a streetwalker, but I'm living my life.
Our next clip comes from our episode with Miss Thea Vidal. She is one of the most honest people I've ever met in my life. And the story that she tells us is very serious and could have had deadly consequences. Let's listen.
The Texas Outlaw Comics. Okay, so I made regular after I did a guest set. I just made regular, and they were just looking at me. And it was cute. I was like the lady with the four babies, and it was cute.
Yeah, you were a unique voice at the time.
I was a unique voice. So then, but they were still mean to me. And
who was mean to you?
The men, mostly the men.
Really?
Yeah, they were mean. They were really mean. Black men, white men, they was all mean.
They just didn't feel like women had a place in comedy, you think?
They didn't feel like I should be there. That's how I took it as a woman. I took it, but it was just be any woman that usurped them. And I didn't give a fuck about what they said. And I didn't bow down, and I didn't suck dick either.
And that probably pissed them off.
And
the
I'm
most.
Not doing none of that shit. But I will put a hole in you, though, motherfucker. I will put a hole in you. I fought men physically. Mm-hmm. I fought men.
I believe you.
But they didn't know that I had fought men before, that they thought that they were the first men I would fight. Oh, yeah, I'll bust you up. You keep fucking with me. I gave my husband a black eye. He sent me on to my mama with a note. You got the wrong one, bitch.
Nick, please get Miss Thea anything she wants for the rest of the show. I want to make sure we stay safe.
This is why I stay behind the desk.
I'm just saying. I'm saying to you that men in the 80s thought that comedy was their domain, and no, the fuck, it wasn't. And it wasn't going to be while I was here. No, it wasn't. And I was going to do what I wanted to do and say what I wanted to say, how I wanted to say, well, you need to be clean. You need to kiss my ass.
This is fascinating to me, and you don't have to name names, but maybe can you tell me a specific something that happened that maybe will just kind of like sum up what it was like for you there?
Okay. I went to the comedy show, not the comedy showcase, the comedy store, right? And that's by Westheimer.
Okay.
Back in Houston. And I went there, and Sharon Menzel, who owns it, her and her husband, Paul, some of the black comics, they were men. Al Freeman was talking about me. And Rashawn McDonald, who happened to be Steve Harvey's manager a couple years ago, big millionaire now, egged him on to do it.
Now, be on stage, off stage?
Talk? On stage.
Oh,
so he's mythic about me. Okay. Calling me fat, calling me, and I was just like looking at Sharon like, let me get him. Let me get this fucker off me. And she's saying no. And he just keeps on, and people are laughing. And I said, get him. And he called me ugly. And she said, get him. Because I'm not ugly. I don't give a fuck what nobody say. I'm an attractive black woman. I may be big, but
you're
I'm attractive.
Gorgeous. Brian and, is ugly.
Hold
on. So she said, get him. So it was my turn to go up on stage. And Al made the mistake of talking about me, but Al was a little ugly gnome. Al Freeman, he was an ugly little gnome. Had tiny little ears, big ass nose.
I remember Al Freeman.
Big eyes. He looked like a little fucking, I don't know, gremlin. And not the cute one either, the gizmo. So anyway.
He looks like an intellectual that's always wrong.
He looks like a gremlin that ate after me.
It's just so the next thing, motherfucker, he gonna say that. So they introduced me and they sat on stage. Oh, baby. When I say I fucked him up, I fucked him up till I got tired. I kept talking about his ass. I talked about him. I said, you got a face only a mama could love, and she's lying. I said, bitch, when she had you, you's a wasted fuck. You know, I just went off. I said, look at you, got beady little eyes like a rat, you little fucking vermin. I talked about this motherfucker so bad that after I got off and I got all this applause, I went in the back. Toodly doodly doodly. So now, Rashawn McDonald, he mad. I said, and his boyfriend Rashawn. I talked about Rashawn on stage too. It's like, and if I said, look at them two faggots sucking each other off.
I'm sure in Houston, Texas, that was a big,
the big insult. Yeah, that's a big XL. So
in the 80s,
you better know it. But anyway, the next thing I know, Rashawn looking at me, talking about what you looking at. I said, nothing. What you looking at? And that's when I wore that Tina Turner wig. Uh-huh. And he pushed me. Can you believe that? He pushed me. A grown man pushes a woman.
This is Steve Harvey's manager.
Yeah. So I pushed him back. So he pushed me again. And I pushed him down on top of another man. I said, fuck with me and see. That by chance, ooh, by chance. So he was so mad. He took my wig off and threw it in the rafters. I didn't give a fuck because my hair was slick back in a ponytail. My hair was good, and I had long hair then. So, fuck you. You took the wig. Oh, well. But your ass was on the ground, bitch, and I knocked you there. By fluke, I usually carry my gun in my briefcase.
Let's call it divine providence that you didn't have it at this point.
And I opened that briefcase and I didn't have that gun. I said, God saved his life. He don't know it. I told him 2 months later, I said, God saved your life. Because usually I carry my gun and I didn't have my briefcase that day. I was going to shoot you because that's how I roll. I was going to kill you or at least wound you. And he looked at me and...
Are you comfortable? Do you want some more water? Can we get you anything at all? Like,
I'm just being honest with you. At that time,
would you like us to go hang your purse for a safe distance?
I was a battered wife and everything. I couldn't.
Would you like us to put your purse over there?
Yeah, maybe in the next room.
Yikes. That was intense. Let's have a little bit of a palate cleanser. Let's get silly. Our next clip comes to you from our pal Brad Williams, who's done the show twice. This particular time, he regales us with a true story about legendary wrestling announcer Jim Ross.
All right, now I want to talk to you about something really important, stuff. Yeah. You just got back from the Chris Jericho cruise.
I did. It was amazing.
You were smiling from ear to ear about it.
It's the best. I fanboyed out so much. I had Chris Jericho, whose birthday is today.
Oh, happy birthday,
He's 48
Chris.
Years old.
No way.
He's 48. He's doing lion salts at age 48. Yep. It's crazy.
Wow.
Think about what your dad was doing at 48 and now watch Chris Jericho do a fucking lion salt. It's awesome.
Yeah, you're right. My dad was a pussy. I didn't realize it until just now.
Yeah, well. All the other dads do it.
Yeah, he had this great cruise where he had comedians, he had heavy metal bands, he had wrestlers. He put a wrestling ring in the middle of a boat, and he had all these fantastic wrestlers who went for it. They were not doing... like matches where you're like, okay, let's save our bodies. They're like, nah, let's go. Let's do it.
I can't imagine amazing. Trying to do wrestling on a boat. Like, yeah, that doesn't seem like a safe thing.
Standing on the top rope on a moving ship.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like the best idea.
It wasn't.
It was a terrible idea.
But it was amazing. I loved it. Every second of it. And then he had legends on the boat. Like, I had a conversation with Ricky the Dragon Steamboat.
Whoa,
like how awesome. Like when did you think that was ever going to happen? One of the greatest moments ever in my career happened where I was doing a live podcast. I think it was Conan's Keeping It 100 podcast, and JR was a guest. Okay?
Oh wow!
So there's six people on as a guest, and someone brings up from the audience someone yells out, "Brad, tell the John Stamos story." And for those of you who don't know, it's a story where John Stamos is afraid of little people. He has something called achondroplastophobia, where he is legitimately scared of little people. And Bob Saget knows this, and Bob Saget knows me. So Saget organized a meeting to where I ran in to see John Stamos, and he was not expecting it. And I just grabbed Stamos' leg and started humping and freaked him the fuck out. Okay, he was scared. So I told that story about humping Stamos' leg, and someone yelled out, "Hump Christopher Daniels' leg." He's a wrestler.
Right.
And I go, "I will hump his leg under one condition, that JR commentates it."
Oh my all right, god!
He's getting up there, Kane. He's gonna get up there by his leg. And that little fella, look at him, he's just climbing up on top of that rope there.
It was the best. I start humping his leg, and through the microphone I hear JR going, "He's going at him like a rabid squirrel."
He's halfway up his knee now.
"My god, that leg is broken in half. Someone stop the damn humping.
It's finished. It's finished.
It's over." It's so great. It's so awesome.
Can you just not like imitate JR all freaking day long?
How much would you pay? People talk about, like, "I want Morgan Freeman to narrate my life. I want Jim Ross to just follow me around, especially when I'm having sex with my wife. Just, by God, she is broken in half." Like, that'd be
such a stomping a mud hole, folks. Yeah.
One of our good friends does the best JR, and we would drive to gigs together, and we would just make him do it the entire drive.
It's amazing.
And if you just pull random things that he says, they make no sense, but if you scream them, they're hysterical. Our favorite of all time, JR line.
I don't like it. Mm-hmm. JR, I don't like it. I tell you, he's trying to do this. I don't like it. I want to go to a restaurant with JR, and they bring him like the fish, and it's not cooked correctly. He's like, "I don't like it."
Our favorite is that when he was the Undertaker, was beating somebody up, and he just goes, "My God, his hands are taped."
"The Taker's hands are taped. The Taker's hands are taped."
Like, but he sells it so well.
Why does that
matter?
He
says it with such passion, where you start watching going, "Yeah, his hands are taped."
There might be something to this wrestling.
No remorse.
You're right. This is some
bullshit. That man's got a family, damn it.
He gets so indignant.
It's so great.
He's a heartless bastard.
He would be... If they did JR's divorce court where he was the judge... Oh, how much would you watch that?
Now, what here is this Xbox thing you're talking about? Now, what? Now, how does this thing work here, y'all?
Just like saying sayings from Oklahoma that make no sense whatsoever. Like, you can ride a mule, but they can't always run. Everyone knows that. You're like...
No one knows that.
What does that mean? What is
no
that?
One knows that.
I feel like your case is three shirts short of a wardrobe, all right?
your barbecue sauce has plenty of hickory, but no spice.
Now, I'll tell you what here.
What does that mean? JR!
Before I rule, I'd like to take a minute and talk about my beautiful beef jerky I make here in the back. And my JR spices. He's the best. I talked to him at StarCast. I was up at StarCast, and I ran into him. I ended up talking to him twice, and I've been trying to convince him to come to town. I don't think it's going well.
Well, I've been wrong before. Jim Ross will actually be at Comedy at the Carlson on St. Patrick's Day coming up this year, so make sure you get your tickets for that. Now, our next clip is a really interesting one. When we do the show sometimes, we end up getting some cool little stories off the side, and this is one of those. This is our friend Josh Wolf, who tells us the story about watching George Carlin work out on stage for his very last comedy special. Very interesting, the meticulous nature of George. So, here you go.
There's a difference for me between who I think are the greatest and who influenced me the most.
100%.
Who are my favorite, probably. Yeah. Like, you know, the greatest, the people who basically the godfathers of comedy, that's an easy one with Carlin and and Pryor and all those.
Nobody's going to argue with that Mount Rushmore.
No. But for me, Kinison. Kinison was the first guy I ever remember because Pryor is before my time.
Did you see this
record? No. Oh, amazing. Yeah, amazing. So Pryor before my time. Mm-hmm. Carlin when he was really good before my time. Yeah. Late Carlin to me was a little too soapboxy and wasn't straight comedy.
He was a little upset.
Yeah, and you know what was fascinating, by the way? So you have people who enjoy comedy on this podcast? Yeah. Okay.
Let's talk comedy, man, all day. Right.
So I was working the door at the Comedy Store, and George Carlin was working his new hour out. And I was like, I need to be there that weekend. I want to watch this shit. Because I, in my brain, thought I knew who George Carlin was and how he worked. Because when you listen to him, he just seems like this dude who's a free-flowing, conversational, natural, I'm just saying whatever comes to my head, the most rote, meticulous.
That meticulous is exactly the word I was
to the to the breath. You know, he would say, first of all, don't talk to me when I'm on stage. I will not talk back to you. If you talk to me, you will be asked to leave. He wanted to get that special 259 minutes to the second, counting your laughter, your applause. So he always asked, do not clap until the end of the joke. How will you know when it's the end of the joke? I'll bow, which is what he did towards the end. And that's when you knew it was okay to clap. If you clapped.
Now that's some like Pavlovian shit.
But if you clapped during the middle, you threw off 59 minutes that he knew. He was down, you know, when he was so memorized.
Yeah.
But he was so memorized, it seemed conversational. But to the word, an hour monologue basically is what he memorized to the breath. And if he messed up, if he stuttered, he would start that joke over. He would, in the Comedy Store, middle of a joke, he would stutter, mess it up. He would go, all right, folks, and he would go right back to the beginning and do it again. He wasn't there for your response.
And that's quite an interesting luxury to have.
Yes. Yeah. But you're Carlin.
Yeah.
But you're Carlin. But you know what? When you like, when I know when there are guys practicing their hour, I've seen them mess a joke up and go back and start it again.
Yeah.
Because if they're practicing their hour and they're doing it like upstairs in the belly room of the Comedy Store or wherever, they're just going to go ahead and run it and they might practice. But to watch him, and I was like, oh my God, that is not at all what I thought was going to happen.
Our next clip is from our interview with the legendary Mr. Bobby Collins. Bobby tells us a story of performing at the last presidential inauguration for President Donald J. Trump. He's got a set of balls on him, that Bobby Collins. Here you go.
If money is your God, then you have no soul.
Okay.
There's a lot of things left in life. Integrity. I have a special needs daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And, she's opened up my heart huge. And it's all about honesty, integrity, all the things we grew up with. Or at least I did. And when you don't see that in other people, they're losing. And ones that use money as your, you know, where you sit in a restaurant, what kind of car you drive, the house you live in, and you talk about money, are you out of your mind? Yeah. Sorry you have no soul. That's the only thing about that. And California is a lot of that.
Yeah. That's some straight up biblical stuff right there. I mean, well, it really is. I mean, it's just the kind of stuff I heard all the time as a kid. Don't worship money. Don't chase money. And you're not wrong.
See?
You're not wrong.
When you come across it a lot, you don't want to be around it.
If money makes you have no soul, I'm all soul.
He's no money, but look at his heart. Where's it on his sleeve?
Soul, baby.
Well, I people have said my heart is enlarged. Like, so, you know, no, I guess that, maybe.
That's a medical condition.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's different.
You take pills for that.
Yeah. Oh, man. Do they make you rich? So you kind of know Trump a little bit. When you go and you play the White House, is that the first time you ever did the White House? What's that like walking up to that place?
No, I played for the Clintons.
Oh, for the Clintons. Yes. Okay.
My second time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Matter of fact, my wife, Bobby, you can get a lot of jobs. Don't do your political stuff. I go, honey, you got to tell the truth. You're a comic. Yeah. I remember, I'll tone it down. I remember as soon as they introduced me, I went, ladies and gentlemen, we have a new president of the United. They went nuts. I go, I guess orange is the new black. They went nuts.
Oh, geez.
And I opened it up.
He's sitting there. Did he laugh?
He afterwards, he came over to me and said, good show, Bobby. And I started to crack up. I said, thank you, Mr. President. Like, you're the fucking president? Are you out of your fucking mind? You should be on 42nd Street. And then he said, can I ask? And he had his boys around him. We represent the Lollipop Guild. You know, it's
right. Shot. Right.
36 of them have been indicted.
Yeah.
Talk about the swamp. This guy brought the Everglades in. And he asked me, he goes, Bobby, can I? I go, sure, what? He goes, did you vote for me? I said, I would have rather voted for El Chapo.
You said that to him.
Yeah.
You said that to the now president of the
United States.
Bobby Collins has the biggest balls on the planet, ladies and gentlemen.
You're a comic. You get paid to have fun.
Okay, so the reaction to
he didn't laugh.
I'll bet he did.
His boys laughed. He gave me the look like, but I came back Mar-a-Lago about a year later, March.
I'd have rather voted for El Chapo.
Hey, look, you're making it like I'm brave. I'm a comedian.
You're making a joke. Job. I get it. But let me tell you something.
Sitting president of the United
It's the
States.
Sitting president. But you're sitting
but
there making...
Not,
even that
ass.
Face makes you brave.
People don't see it. Remember, dumb people don't know they're dumb.
It was really tough trying to pick the clips for this episode. We wanted to keep it to about an hour. So if you enjoyed it, please make sure you subscribe. We're available on iTunes. We're available on Spotify. We're available on iHeartMedia. We're available on Laughable. We're available on YouTube. And you can watch us live and see our beautiful faces every Friday morning right on Facebook. Visit Comedy at the Carlson sometime soon. Come see a show. We have the best performers in the world right here for you. Gift cards are available right now for the holiday season. So for more information, please visit carlsoncomedy.com. And to subscribe to this show if you haven't yet, carlsoncast.com. We'll see you soon. We're going to be back this Friday with our friend, Mr. Chris Frangiola.